Hey, everybody, it's Katrina with Zooming in the Lens, and welcome to part two with my friend Hank Fortner. Hank is the creator of AdoptTogether.org and World Adoption Day, which is on November 9th. So far, they've raised $8 million, and they have garnished support from people like Ellen DeGeneres and Shaquille O'Neal and thousands of other people that are supporting this crowdfunding way to cut the red tape for families that want to adopt. We all know how many babies and children need loving homes, and it could be really rough out there for people that want to adopt. It could be anywhere from, you know, $20,000 to $120,000 to offer love to somebody and to give back and to receive as well. So Hank is the catalyst behind all of this, and him and his wife and his two daughters, incredible karma yogis, as far as I'm concerned. They don't go by that. What they go by and what Hank goes by is Christian, and Hank is a Christian pastor. So I was really excited to have him on because I wanted to talk about the different uses of the word spirituality. You know, religion has theirs, and spiritual people who are not feeling that religion resonates for them are using the word spirituality too. And I think that there's a common ground and something that we're all trying to get that and give. And I do believe that to be love. So what better than to have somebody like Hank on? In part one, he went over his incredible story of growing up in Ohio, where he had two siblings of his own, pretty sure it was two siblings of his own, and his mom and dad went on to adopt eight kids from six different countries. And it was really painful at times because they started out with foster care and they'd have a brother or sister and then they would get taken away. Through that suffering, what came out of it is what we're seeing right now. AdoptTogether.org. This is karma yoga, the yoga of skillful action. And Hank's unique position of being a pastor as well allows us to see this through maybe not such a clouded vision for some of what religion is. When I started to, let's say, chip away the paint on my lens of my life and the roles and the models and the stories that I built up about what's right and what's wrong, even from my Roman Catholic childhood and getting kicked out because I asked too many questions, I was able to revisit scripture from so many different religions and find beauty and power and love in a lot of them. So it's interpretation partly. I'm not saying that there's not extremists out there and there's not fundamentalists out there. And no, everybody's not using everything for good. But, you know, I think we've all read the memes enough now to know that the change has to start with us. So I left off part one, where I inquired into religious people being perceived to some as working with the word love in a conditioned frame. In a lens of that maybe seems clouded because there is what I guess we would call religious dogma, or is it? So welcome to part two with Hank Fortner as we dive into some other topics. I stand in great honor of being able to have him on here and to help us all just find a place to meet in the middle, because love should not have red tape. Thank you. Enjoy part two. How in the world has anybody gotten away with this?
Yeah.
Is it because as a culture, curiosity has been squeezed out of us? All of the parts of us that question everything has been filled in. The space is gone, and what's in place of it is In order to be successful, you have to know.
Mm-hmm.
Know what? Anything. Doesn't matter.
Right.
You have to know the stock market to be a stockbroker.
Sure, right.
You have to know parenting to be a parent.
Right.
And everybody is too scared to be vulnerable, mm-hmm. which is what you're saying is, what was that phrase that you used that I looked at it as vulnerability but didn't say it out loud? You were saying that, oh, I forget now. Anyway, it'll come back to me.
Yeah, totally.
Vulnerability to be standing there and saying, I don't know.
Right,
and
sure.
And so because clergy
mm-hmm.
is looked at to give us something,
yeah.
the word of God,
mm-hmm.
the rules, the Ten mm-hmm. Commandments, even in yoga,
mm-hmm.
the eight limbs. This is a guru. I need to go to India and study with that person.
Right.
I can't find it within myself. All of it is subject to dogma.
Sure.
Not just...
And I would put... And I think to your point about all of it being subject to dogma, I think that's what... Because I think it would be a... For me, it would be a misrepresentation to say that religions believe in love except for certain people. I don't think your average Catholic, Muslim, Jew, Hindu, Buddhist, anybody would say, or Christian, would say, there are people in the world I don't love. I don't think any of them would go, yeah, no, we don't love those people. And maybe I'm wrong, or maybe I'm misrepresenting, but at least of the Christian, Catholic, Jewish side, I don't think they would say, yeah, those are people that we don't love. I think God being love and God loving people is universal. I think what the driving force of where you get that friction is when a person has an opposing view of my existence or of the existence that I believe that God's given me or this holiness or words like truth.
But those are conditions.
Sure.
Right? Love's not conditioned. It
right.
is in the human sense. But if I – religion is loving – and I'm not interested in doing love.
Sure.
Because if I do love, when there's a conflicting belief system, I'm going to say, no, that's not how to do it.
Sure.
And who the hell am I?
Right. But I think there's a – I just think there's my – and I'm not defending again, I'm not defending dogma. I just think it exists all universally.
So do I. So
and I think it exists among yogis.
Absolutely.
And I think it exists among vegans. The amount of vegans that judge me to death
Absolutely.
Over eating chicken, which I shouldn't eat. I just shouldn't. It's full of antibiotics and Prozac and disgusting things, and I never give it to my kids. I shouldn't eat that. I know. I should not eat animal products. I am universally aware of that. But when I get a judgy vegan, it makes me want to eat a raw steak right in front of them because I go, back off. And in my sense, I think it's the same thing in a religious space.
Is,
I don't think that religions are against love or have lost it. I think where you get that religious tension, and again, there's a thin slice of every single religion in the world that is full of hate, and people use it to fundamentally bring about pain in the world. And so I think that's what we're seeing with the Muslim extremists. I think that's what you see with Westboro Baptist Church.
Yes, but at the core.
But at
the
true teachings of all those faiths are beautiful and sincere and loving and compassionate and kind human beings.
And it's about being open.
And it is about being open and saying there is a God. And if a person of faith has an argument with a person that would say they were atheist or is a non-believer or those negative words that I very much dislike, it does come from a place of, I want you to know the God I know. It doesn't translate as that. But it does come from, I think that is the driving narrative for a person who has found that. Just like that vegan is going to argue with me out loud at a restaurant, which happened to me in LA, about my body being a graveyard for a dead animal.
Right.
Because he cares about the planet, and he cares about animals, mm-hmm. and he actually cares about what I'm doing to my own body. There is maybe a thin layer of this guy being right, but he's arguing with me as I'm arguing back. Because he cares about something.
Because the energy that he's using to argue with you could actually go for skillful action.
Yes.
And that's what I think religion is spending so much time defending.
But yes.
And there's no need, like, just be. Like, when you're
yes.
a vegan.
It's practice.
Yes.
It's practice. If that vegan just stays vegan and outlives us.
Absolutely.
We are one generation away from all being vegans
anyway. Of course,
anyway.
It's just the law of nature. I mean, look
we
at it.
We are running out of space and energy
right.
and waste. to keep farming animals the way we are.
That's right.
Additionally, when all the people who are, by the way, veganism is new. It is newly popularized and newly all. One generation from now, the oldest people on this planet and the healthiest people on this planet will be vegans and we'll all know.
Yeah.
But if they go around and try to tell people the way they're doing it is wrong, it's not going to work. The best thing a vegan can do is to build the most beautiful restaurants in the world, is to give me the most extraordinary experience in the world with via food. And I bought a vegan cookbook because I went to dinner at my friend's house and he fed me this vegan food I couldn't believe. And I felt more energy and I felt better. And now I'm vegan a couple of days a week.
There you go.
Because I go. Because
you were inspired.
He invited me into his practice.
Right, I hear you, dude.
As opposed to telling me philosophically what it is. And to me, every faith ought to be assessed. Not based on, can I articulate something you believe while you're listening to this podcast?
That's right.
That's just, to me, that's bullshit. That's a process of you trying to make sure that you've got your world in order. Just like it would be for me listening to someone and going, well, does he say the right things about God or existence or creation or evolution? That, to me, is just such a waste of time. What I want to invite people to do whenever I speak and whenever I invite people to things is to say, if we can take a deep breath and say, how does this practice affect my life? And I always drive it back towards practice. If your spiritual practice does not make you healthier, make you more compassionate, more loving, more the characteristics that you believe that God is, you should abandon all those practices and maybe the people who are teaching them to you. But if your practice moves you towards more loving, more open, more centered, in a place where you're giving more to the world than you're taking, in a place where there's more life in you, more resurrection energy in you. Move towards that energy.
Yeah.
That's a phrase I always tell people, even in dating, is I say follow the energy. And they'll go, the repressive Christian upbringing brings a person to the, well, should I do this and should I not do this? And is this the right and is this healthy and what the? And I just go, follow the energy. Because when it's good energy, it will lead you to a good place. If it's bad energy, you usually know right away. And when you try to do all this thinking about philosophies along the way, all you're doing is trying to force the energy into something. That's called repression. That's called fundamentalism. That's called just trying. That's control. And inevitably, that control, that fundamentalism, those things are bad energy. And it's actually neurologically bad for your brain.
Mm.
Fundamentalism makes you dumber. And it's a necessity that your brain has to control its environment.
Yeah.
It is a fear-based reptilian brain function that makes you dumber. It makes you process less. And there's fundamentalism in every religion on the planet. I've met fundamentalist yogis, and I just go, you're letting parts of your brain die when you're fundamental.
That's right.
Versus when you can stay open and stay fresh and surrender to curiosity.
To me, it's a great indication, because I can learn from people that are in both places.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great indication of where I need the work if I feel a constriction inside of me when somebody says something and I am like, no, that's not true or whatever. That allows me to direct my practice. It's just that if you don't practice what I'm calling cultivate the witness, which is really what you're saying, which is point the finger back at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a self-deprecation way. Not in a way of like, I need to be more like him. Or it's more that you're a scientist on a discovery. And the greatest experiment you are walking around in.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of investigating everybody else's bodies and words, if somebody says something that pisses you off, whether you yell back it or not is not even the point. The point is at some point a practice becomes asking yourself, not what part do I have to play in this? Because the part your brain will just go, you shouldn't have yelled back. Who cares? You should have. You did.
Right. Totally.
Because we're all human.
Yeah. Totally.
You yelled back. Now what?
Yep.
And the practice of cultivating the witness is allowing you to use that imagination and stand almost as a scientist. You know what a scientist is? It's somebody that doesn't, if they're good, It's not somebody that has a point to prove. It's somebody that's there to observe everything in its natural habitat.
Totally.
So let's imagine the witness is the scientist.
Sure.
Observe yourself in your natural habitat. Did you just tell this person that he's an asshole?
Sure.
Okay, interesting. Stand as the witness and find out what is that serving in you? And most likely, at least for, I'd say 40% of the self-dialogue that I have, it's to make myself seem and feel better about me.
Right, totally.
I need to be great, you're wrong.
Totally.
So that's just a tiny microcosm of the giant world of conventional, traditional religion.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what you're about.
And I'm not. And what I am about, I love that. The way I would say I'm a scientist is slightly different. I don't observe myself in my natural environment. And I do that. But I'm also a scientist like the guy who goes, I'm out to prove if things are real or alive. So imagine that a scientist, like just recently, their scientists are trying to figure out the addictive or medicinal effects of marijuana on a person's brain.
Yeah.
And the American Medical Association, when they outlawed marijuana, said we are inconclusive on the effects of marijuana on a person's body and brain, whether it's addictive and whether it's actually negative, and we would like more time. And the political forces that be and the pharmaceutical industry did not want it out and about, right? So there's all those things. So what scientists have been doing since and are doing now is they are putting artificial environments together to see how you will react. So what I love about things like practice or like church or like all these things is to go, can I put myself into a church by nature is an artificial environment, a temple, a practice, a mindfulness studio. That's an artificial environment. That is not real life. That is a stepping out of real life.
Yeah, but do you really think this is real life? That depends on what you think.
It's
relatively real.
It's relatively real.
If you believe it's 100% real, you have nowhere to go.
Yes, but I would put it in, just like my CrossFit gym is not real life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing that to survive. I'm doing that to flex the survival muscles that I no longer need for this day and age, mm-hmm. so that I am healthier for that real life that I have. And it is real. It's a real thing, but it is an artificial environment that I pay $190 a month to be a part of. It's not a real environment. My yogi teacher, who I'm paying $47 to Bikram me for 2 hours, we are not friends. This is a transaction in an environment that she has created to make this experience happen for me, so that I'm better in my life, which I still think fits for that science. For me, I don't release any of my fundamental beliefs, and I'll put those words at fundamental, not in the sense that I protect them above all else, but that they're at the bottom. The reason that I make my colleagues nervous in Christianity by having these kinds of conversations and talking about things like follow the energy and those kinds of things is because they're still trying to defend things that I already believe transcend defense.
Well, isn't that embodying versus doing? Yeah.
To me, you and I, we can't ask a single question of God that will reveal his inexistence. We are going to, and you might define it differently, and I might define it differently, might come to that place. But by the conversation, by the disputatio, mm-hmm. I will walk away with a more profound understanding of the God that I believe created me at the beginning of time, out of this primordial moment. So to me, it's like, it's not that I'm immovable from that. I'm willing to ask any question of God. And I heard a guy say something so beautiful. He says in the Genesis account, is it possible that when God said in Genesis 2, there's this phrase that I've always quoted. In Genesis 2:25, it says the men and women were naked and they felt no shame. Mm. And I've always said that's Burning Man. Except I feel shame.
Or it was last
looking
night
at Burning
me.
Man. Yeah, or it was last night. If men and women were naked and felt no shame. It's the CrossFit bodies. It's whatever it is. That when they started to feel shame, it's actually when they walked in the garden with the cool of the day that God put skin on them when sin entered the world. And that's when we actually, and so these bodies we've always felt trapped in, and we've always tried to find out of body experiences.
Why did he do that? Like, what does your belief system say that is the reason for that?
See, I don't actually know if that's... I just heard that last week, and I thought it was so fascinating. So no, that's something fascinating. That's something I'm playing with. And
it's
going,
a good thing to
and
ponder.
Looking at the Hebrew to go, did God put skin on Adam and Eve?
Well, it's a mythology. We all know that, right?
It's a poem.
But what does it mean to put skin on? It means to be... To create suffering because you're encapsulating something. You're putting something on something. Mm-hmm. And so I would look at it as our human predicament. We're constantly putting something on something. I got to get married. I got to have a baby. I got to have a company. I got to have another company. I got to have a podcast.
Sure.
You know, in the material sense of things. But I'm going to go out on a limb.
Do it. I love limbs.
All right.
I love limbs.
I cannot imagine that that was anything other than a gift.
100%.
All right.
This body
now,
is not
but
a...
But define that for everybody.
This physical body that I hold, that your soul is encapsulated in, and I've said this for years and it makes my colleagues nervous as well, you are not a human being having a spiritual experience. You are a spiritual being having a human experience.
I say that a lot.
It is you, this humanity, this body, but it's not also, I get so frustrated when I hear people say they are only human or I'm just human. So of course I made that mistake. Your humanity is the most spiritual part of you. Your humanity and your connection to other human beings. My fundamental origin belief. No matter what a person believes, if the Garden of Eden was a real place, or if a snake really walked up to a woman and talked her into eating an apple, or if that's how God punished the world, however a person takes those things, I go, God created man in his image. And there is a divinity inside of all of us that we carry. And that our humanity was the gift that God said, I'm going to give this thing to you. It's a reflection of me. Mm-hmm. And it's the way, it's rare that a person would say, My favorite moments of my life are the ones where I felt inhumane.
No.
It's mostly when a person feels most centered and most aware of their... If we could get into more touch with our physiology, it's what this vegan experience is for me. Mm. I'm more in touch with my body through exercise and health and through not eating a thing that has been killed or died in the making. There is something to that because I'm more aware of this human thing. The more we treat each other like humans, it's why this thing that just happened in Brussels mm-hmm. is such a riff. And no matter what a person's spirituality is, you feel the loss because you go, that's inhumane. Mm-hmm. Because the humanity is the gift God gave all of us.
In the sin, in the skin.
Yeah, all of it.
In the suffering.
All of it.
And that is the fundamental hard part about being human.
Yeah.
Is how to say that to somebody as they're dying
mm-hmm.
and how to hold space for that at the same time as that is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
It also sucks.
In unimaginable ways. To lose
Isn't
someone.
Isn't that duality then?
It's
That's what I'm saying.
To lose someone, you have to have the capacity to hold conflicting. I feel like this is what mindfulness does for me. I feel like this is what meditation is. I feel like this is what maturity is the ability to hold conflicting ideas in the same That's space, right. in the same body. We hold in our souls conflicting ideas. I am both a very faithful husband and father and a selfish bastard.
Right.
I am both of those things. The scriptures describe it as you have a flesh and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And where the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak. And your soul, your spirit longs for to be righteous and longs That's to be right. holy and longs to do right and do good and be the best. And then you have this thing called the flesh, which is really annoying because it makes you a shitty dad.
Right.
And it might make you a selfish husband. And it makes you do things that hurt other people out of selfishness or out of self-protection or insecurity. It makes you a douchey at parties.
Yep.
And the insecurity wins and those voices. It's that there is within us this, in some sense, duality or this coexistence of a good and bad. It's a universe. A universe of all those things. And to me, the experience of spiritual maturity and the odyssey of growing in your own spiritual inward journey is not to try to purge yourself of the bad and purge yourself of the wrong or purge yourself of the selfish, but to let it coexist, not to even purge yourself of suffering, is to hold them in that same place and say one is heavier than the other. So I'll let suffering live, but joy is going to be heavier in my life than suffering.
So balance, right?
It's going to center me. And yeah. How many things have I suffered through and looked back on and said, what a gift that was?
I mean, I very rarely hear people say that it's not.
Yeah. I asked a guy what the best thing has ever happened to him in his life. He said, my dad got cancer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It changed everything for him. Changed who he was. Changed his relationship with his father. His father survived that cancer. Changed the trajectory of their whole lives. And in the moment, if I had said, this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to you, then I'm a dick.
Absolutely.
I'm a terrible person.
You don't go walking around telling
people
that.
You don't tell people that. But as a friend, I know that's where he's going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
So I walk with him in it. And is it possible that maybe where God sits when a person who's even listening to this story who has cancer or going through a divorce or is dealing with unimaginable pain, that God is just with you? That's why the Jews have this phrase, Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit Shiva because they just go, I'm not going to give you some pithy
Hindu god
BS thing. Shiva's a Hindu god.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to give you some pithy thing that's going to make you try to feel better. I'm not going to send you a meme off Facebook.
No.
Like someone said, hey, my friend's mom just died. Is there a scripture that I could
somebody
send him?
Somebody just asked me
and I said,
for a quote.
No.
I said
no.
It. Now I feel horrible.
Oh, no. I said, don't send him a scripture. There's not a thing in the world. If I lose a family member and someone texts me a scripture, I'm going to be like, screw this guy. I don't want to.
And God.
Yeah. Like, don't do. You know what you need to do is just say, I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you a thing to your home. I'm going to come over to your house and just do dishes while you cry.
Yeah.
I'm going to be present and be with you. And there's,
that's,
you know,
impossible if you think you know it all.
Yes.
So the curiosity,
yeah,
the being vulnerable. I mean, I'm not saying these things like just go buy Curiosity for $10.99,
yeah, sure,
at
totally.
Radio Shack.
Although I do have a DVD series about it. I'm kidding.
And at the end of this podcast,
there is an online course you can take for $10.99 a day. No, you're right. There's not a way. It is a process. It is a journey. It is an exploration.
But if you're open.
Yes.
If you're just... All right, let's not even say open, okay? Because open is scary,
right,
to a lot of people.
Sure.
Let's say, question whether the anger you have for somebody that holds an alternative belief to yours, I would like to know how that is benefiting you and others.
It's a great question.
For longer than a couple of years.
Sure.
Like, really.
Or ever.
Ever, but...
And you know what's crazy? I don't know what kind of Christian people you've run into.
I think but the rest one... of the world... I mean, when I found out that you were Christian, when I found out that I can come and see you talk as a pastor, I had to go.
But I don't know what kind of Christian people you've run into, but and maybe this is just L.A., and maybe this is just my friends who I surround myself with. But I don't know Christian people who hate people who don't believe like they do.
No, but what I know, and that's fair enough.
So to me, like, even hating a person who's like, oh, this guy's a Jew or a Buddhist or a Muslim or whatever.
That's probably a strong word.
Yeah, right.
What I do hear from Christians, and I couldn't say what lineage.
Yeah.
This is the way.
Yeah, totally.
Okay?
For sure.
So what does that mean? How could you remain open in the Zen don't know mind?
Sure.
And tell me that there is the way.
But don't you hear that in so many... Don't you hear that from vegans? And don't you hear that from certain yogis?
I do.
And don't you hear that all over? I think that...
But I'm not taught in that lineage.
Sure. No, totally. And I think that is a person who takes as they stand going, I'm going to say this is the way because I've never been your way. And I've never been down that road. This is the way that I have found that is the way. They're saying this is the way. It's like me saying, how do I get to your house? I'm going to give you the way.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So I'm just taking it
literally. And you might go, no, I'm coming from a different place. And you're
like
going,
that.
No. But you have to go first. You have to get to where I was, and then you have to get here this way. To me, the transcendence of God, the transcendence of, and I'm going to say his name, so don't let your listeners freak
Let's
out.
Let's go. Ready?
The transcendence of Jesus. The transcendence of Jesus is that you will find him wherever you're looking. Your teacher, who's up on the wall, quoted Jesus.
He did.
Why did he do that?
Jesus is on my picture table. Because Jesus is on your table. A wise being.
And Jesus has this strange way of being quoted by every great religion in the world. Because there's something to the power that Jesus brought the world. And so when people go, Jesus is the way and the only way, and you can't get the way. The way to what? What is
salvation
they offering you? What are they offering?
I don't want to be in purgatory. I want to go to heaven.
Yeah, right.
As if it's an actual place with like steeples and
yeah, totally.
Somebody there saying, "Are you on the guest list?"
Yeah, totally, totally. But you know what's crazy is that if I look around of even like the sects of Christianity, the different sections, there are certain Baptists who are convinced that if you were baptized a certain way, you're not in. And then there's Mormons who believe that if you haven't been baptized this certain way, then you're not in. And then there's all these people who are saying that you're not in. So even the way is going into splitting into all these other different ways. And my assessment—
So it's semantics? Is that what you're telling me?
My assessment would be that people have to lean into the way to what? Everything that Jesus came to bring to this world was that he came to bring it to here now.
Right.
I think that fundamental statement of Jesus is the way to this is a reversal of what Jesus was trying to do. He kept saying over and over, the number one thing Jesus talked about when he was on this planet was a thing called the kingdom of God, a kingdom of heaven, he described. All of religious Christianity to this point has told you that that kingdom is on the other side of this life.
Mm-hmm.
Everything Jesus communicated to you and me through the scriptures was that this is already here. He said in the scriptures in Luke, he says that there are those of you in this room who will not taste death before they see the kingdom of heaven. He's describing that it's already among us. He did this famous sermon. It's 5 chapters in the book of Matthew called the Sermon on the Mount.
Blessed
are those who mourn, for they will see God. Blessed are the righteous. Blessed are the blessed, blessed, blessed. And he's describing what the kingdom looks like. It is already here. Jesus is not a doorway into this other afterlife scenario.
It's a doorway to yourself.
Jesus is already here. When he says he's the way, the question I would ask that person, or that we should ask, or that people should ask, is he's the way to what? To some
ask
promise
the
of
right
some
questions.
He's the promise to some afterlife that we have no evidence of on that
None.
Side? Or is he what he said over and over, which is he's the promise to what is here? And that to me would be the assessment that I would take. Is what evidence does a person who claims Jesus or doesn't claim Jesus, what evidence does their practice show in their day-to-day life? What joy do you see? What compassion do you see? What hope do you see? What love do you see? That is the metric by which I would sit there and go, what is Jesus the way to? The only evidence that he would be the way to something in the afterlife would be what he's the way to in this life. That would be the only evidence. Jesus garnered a following because he gave the best possible information about the most relevant topics of his time. He was the evidence. They tried to make him king. Thousands and thousands of people gathered together to try to make him king, and he would disappear because it wasn't his plan, wasn't his goal. He had the best possible information, which was the evidence that his descriptions of what would happen after this life was responsive because he was changing this life now. So for a person who goes, well, all I have to do is check this box or believe or raise my hand at a convention or whatever to do all this kind of stuff, salvation or all these words of even things like heaven can only be proven through their existence now in this
beautiful,
place.
Beautiful, Hank. Really beautiful. That's powerful.
That's what I would say to those
that
people.
That is so beautiful. I think what catches us is there some club that I haven't been invited to that tells all religious people to tell everybody else not to ask questions,
mm-hmm.
Does this club also say that sinners will go to hell?
Mm-hmm.
Does this club also tell me that I have to get married before I have sex?
Mm-hmm.
How could we have gotten it so wrong if Jesus is love and he said it's here right now? Why aren't we valuing each other? Why is religion not on the incline, but on the decline?
Mm-hmm. I think what you're finding, there's a lot of things there, by the way.
Yeah.
A lot of things there that I don't know that we have time for, or no, I have time for. But I think there's a couple of things. I think you already believe in covenant sex. Unless a person lives in an open relationship.
Monogamy, are you saying?
Monogamy.
Yeah, I don't think it's nature. I do not. I think that that's one of the things that we were. God came down. Should I speak like you?
Do you think your put soul wars on? Against nature?
No. I think my soul is nature.
Yeah. What I'm fascinated by is even people without a Catholic or Christian or Muslim or Jewish upbringing, that a person can still feel a violation when there's an infidelity. So how is it that Bill Clinton gets a blowjob in the Oval Office and the whole world wants to impeach him?
I am with you, brother.
Or let's go to another place and go.
So with you.
Because they feel, because your soul is designed for a covenant relationship of sex.
Do you think?
I'm certain of it. What we
look at this.
What our soul is designed
what is the
for.
What is the title of that article?
Why Humans Choose Monogamy. I'm going to read that later. Carry the biological imprint of polygamy, and what's with one mate for life. Nice.
So this is saying that studies show
for biological survival, polygamy may be a wonderful idea for the purpose of procreation. But we're not talking about procreation to survive as a species to survive. We might be if the planet dies.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not talking about procreation. We're talking about a very new thing, which is sex for feeling, sex for love, sex for those things.
Yeah.
Being wired for that is different and new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I find is that people, I'm always fascinated by this, that people who did not grow up with someone saying that God said that you should have sex inside the context of marriage can feel a violation when someone cheats on somebody, they break up.
But I did grow up in the confines of that. I grew up Roman Catholic.
But there's people who didn't, and their relationships end because they get a blowjob from a friend at work.
Yes, absolutely.
And I go, what is that
because
except
religion religion is also the societal spacesuits we're all wearing. They heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody.
No, they feel it.
Oh, you think
they
it's a
feel
feeling.
The violation.
But if I love
even
you,
if you're
and listen,
dating somebody
I am not
and they go, oh, they cheated on me. That person cheated on me. What is cheating? I'm going, if you're going to have sex
it's
with that person,
it's an assault on your ego.
Well, oh, there you go. Okay, why?
Because the ego wants to be the best. It wants to know. It wants to feel needed. It wants to feel loved.
But it knows it's not the best. I know I'm not the best. I know I'm not the best
lover. That's why you get angry.
I know I'm not the best anything. My wife, my wife knows she's not the best in the whole world. We're not all whoever would be considered the best right now. I think the queen of Instagram this very minute as we record this is Selena Gomez, right? 70 million followers. And Instagram's dying anyway, so whatever. It's going to be a skeleton. But but there's so much of, we all know that we're not the best. Your soul reacts and recoils to what feels like betrayal, words like unfaithful, infidelity.
But do you think there's people walking around here that know they're not the best? I'm talking about wearing it, acting it. No, you're talking about experienced people that are saying, I know I'm not the best, but that's not what we're getting in the social norm.
Right.
We're getting people pretending to be,
sure,
but they feel insecure. So what's going to come out when they're cheated on is going to bring out that monster that's telling them they're not good enough,
that
that's making them act like
yes,
they are.
That could be. That also could be that they feel like we made a deal, that I upheld this faithfulness. I just did a wedding yesterday. I upheld this faithfulness. They committed faithfulness to each other. So polyamory or a person in an open relationship, that they would be aside from that. But it's got to be mutual. It's very rare.
Oh, my word, of course.
It's very rare that you have a person. And I'm saying outside of any theological framework.
Absolutely.
At a soul level.
Totally.
Covenant sex is a deal. It is a real thing. And unless we both agree that we're going to be promiscuous or both agree we're going to be polyamorous, then we're not into this, because there is a leaning on each other. There is a trust. Sex is the most intimate, trusting thing you can do. And when you get to that place where you are going to share that intimate level with your body, when a person takes that outside of the context of that, the violation is felt. The only place you don't feel that violation is when you are in a context where promiscuity is the norm, where you go to college or spring break or any of those things, and you're like, oh, we're just doing these things. We're just doing this. But when you, at the base level, when you finally find that person, then you make some sudden agreement that it's not going to be anybody else. And if it is, then you work through it, and then you work through it, and then you have to forgive a person for violating that. But at the core of it, if that's the case, that when relationships become mature, they move to a place of monogamy. We can only ascertain that our soul actually longs for that monogamy in its infancy and doesn't know any better. It finds its way to that place and then it becomes monogamous. And even more importantly, as relationships mature, there may even be less sex that happens. Because the intimacy that's achieved physically,
I think that's a gift.
Is no longer it's no longer necessary to get there physically.
Yeah,
you can have it and you're there. And then if you were to be physical with someone else, it would also feel like a violation of that intimacy that one carried.
Mm.
So that would be my only, that would be my defense of covenant sex.
Yeah, I mean, I'm monogamous. I am monogamous. But have you ever read The Moral Animal?
No.
Yeah, it's a good book to check out. It's all about the nature and natural, the reason why men can have babies forever. They're constantly able to have babies.
But because at a biological level, we had to. We're not there anymore.
That's right. You're right. And everything needs to evolve.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree. I think there are too
there's almost 8 billion of us. We don't need to have sex for procreation anymore. We could stop and bring it back down to like 3 billion. And then we could be having a conversation, but I think we're going to be fine. The world was in a wonderful place when there were only a billion of us. I think we'd be we're not going to have a procreation conversation for a long time, which is where I think neuroscience, that's what they're assessing, is that base level reptilian, early stage humanity, that when it matures, you have less kids. When any society matures, they have less children per family.
Mm-hmm.
Any society in any place.
To find intimate sex, I had to have a lot of meaningless sex. That's not something that I don't know anybody that just popped out, had sex, and it became profoundly intimate. I mean, intimacy is almost, we're missing rituals and mythology in our culture in a big way. We don't have any initiations besides I'm going to have a bar mitzvah and get $10,000. But without initiation, without any of that, it's almost like life becomes the initiation, which I'm grateful for. So with that model, you're taking your neuroses and then you initiate to this place where they're still there, but now you have a deeper relationship to them, an altered relationship to them, where you're not just, the mind's not the master anymore.
Right.
How are you saying that somebody would just get to immediately having intimate sex? I needed to have that meaningless sex.
Maybe.
That's duality. I had to know sad to know happy.
Yeah, maybe. I think sex is a response of two things. And then I have to go because my wife.
Oh, my word.
My wife is texting me, so then I have to go. Okay. That's real-time updates for your listeners.
Yes, good. I want it.
Is intimacy can be achieved across genders, across relationships, and across even covenants like marriage or friends or any of those things. A person can have intimacy with their children. You can have intimacy with your mother and father. That intimacy exists. That physical intimacy is a one-of-a-kind type of intimacy that when shared otherwise, and I think the polyamorous thing, as it starts to sort of take a life of its own, is going to start to reveal itself. I think it's going to – my prediction is that it'll be a lot like technology. There will be too much of it, and then there will be a recoiling back to this vintage space. Just like now we're recoiling back to mindfulness in places where you go to conferences and they don't let you give your phone.
And they don't even tell you it's Buddhist.
They used to advertise – that you could come to a conference and they'll give you more technology. And now you go to conferences and they make you bench your technology.
That's right, yeah.
We're going to recoil to that because people are going to sense that there's a space inside your soul that's not to be shared. And that's a place that gets to it. When you can find intimacy and trust, you can build that intimacy in that space with that person. You know that was meaningless sex. now in context of the relationship you now have with Tommy?
It was meaningless sex because I didn't have meaning in it.
For sure.
But if I have meaning in my soul, every sex I have is meaningful.
For sure.
So I don't, I think we're just going to have to agree to disagree.
Sure, or, totally.
And I wish everybody else.
Or we do a whole podcast on this because we got some more.
Sex is a huge topic.
Huge.
Because I've got a lot of people that feel very guilty and
yeah,
people
totally.
That think they're going to be sinners. And then people now that are young that are just out there screwing their brains out.
Yeah, totally.
And they're repelling religion because it's saying you're bad if you do.
Yep.
I'm really, really happy to have had you on here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no, it was fantastic.
We just got to the most exciting part right at the beginning, right at the end there. We
should start with sex.
We'll do a sex talk.
I think we need to do a sex talk.
We'll do it.
We do. I want to close this by saying that I liked bringing you on here because you bring new life to Christianity.
Hmm.
I believe that. Yes, we had this talk prior that progressive Christianity is religion evolving.
Mm-hmm.
I like the openness and the feel of it and the way you interpreted the way, that it's really about semantics and it's about me seeing that the way is the way for somebody, but maybe not for others. And I think that that's really what spirituality is.
Mm.
It's that journey. And I'm not to say that your outward journey or your inward journey is the right thing. Who the hell am I? But if we each take care of our inside self and stop worrying about everybody else out there, and there's lots of ways to get in touch with Hank. So I want to tell everybody that because he's obviously, you know, signing a lot of companies on. And we are going to have a sex talk again. There is an article out there from Scientific Mind, A Happy Life May Not Be a Meaningful Life. And they're debating on whether happiness, we should go for happiness or go for meaning, and that happiness is, there's a difference. You would think that they go hand in hand, but they don't. And I want to put this up on my blog. We don't have time to get into it now, but you will be very, very surprised to learn that the daily mundane tasks that we do may bring you, may make you feel like you're not living a meaningful life. But it's people that at the end of the day, when you're happy, it doesn't necessarily mean that you feel like you have a meaningful life. And the statistics that they have found is that meaning in life requires community and helping others and going outside of what you think your mental boundaries are. Oh, I could never adopt. I'm too selfish. Or I could never go and give homeless food to homeless people. I would be embarrassed. That is what science is showing is leading people to have a meaningful life versus happiness, which is just kind of
momentarily.
Thank you. Momentarily. It's an in-the-moment thing. And yes, we're in the moment, but helping others is a way to actually help yourself, however woo-woo that may sound. So to get in touch with Hank, I just want to tell you it's adopt, so it's adopttotether.org. Adopt together, one word, .org. His podcast, he's got two of them, one for Adopt Together and one called that is his own. I asked him what it was about and he said, I have no idea. And that's why I love it and why I want to push it, because if you have an idea, I think you're doomed. None of us have an idea. We're just right. Be vulnerable with
yeah,
it, right?
Absolutely.
So it's called Typically Hazardous. And he also does live recordings of it.
Talks, yeah.
At different bars and all sorts of really cool,
yep.
like, venues.
Next one's at the Bootleg, which is a musical venue here in L.A.
Is it? The Bootleg?
Yep.
And what are they, typically at 7 o'clock-ish?
8 o'clock. 7:30 doors, 8 o'clock. And you can find all that at hankfortner.com.
Oh, good. Hank yep. Fortner. How do you spell your last name?
F-O-R-T-E-N-E-R. Fortenier.
Fortenier. Thank you very much.
If you Google me the wrong name, it'll come up too.
So I want this to be a place where we harvest dispelling all of the misconceptions that we have mm-hmm. about every topic. about God, about Jesus, about life, about adoption. But Hank is really doing an awesome thing here. So if it helps you on an adoption level, perhaps this talk, maybe if it helps you go, you know, maybe what I learned when I was younger doesn't fit me or suit me anymore. And now I have an outlet, somebody like Hank that you can actually listen to lectures on YouTube, where he breathes new life into something that we all have these walls up for. If you don't, great. But question yourself that if somebody doesn't believe in God, do you get mad? Mm-hmm. Do you cast them out because you're no better than somebody who doesn't want to hear about God?
Sure, yeah.
So thank you so much, Hank. And thank you, everybody, for listening. This is Zooming in the Lens with Katrina. And you can find me and Zooming in the Lens online course for Ram Dass at functionalyogaonline.com. See you later.
I think what happens in our mythology is that the symbols, the mythological archetypal symbols, became interpreted as facts. I think it starts with the Old Testament. I think with the Old Testament, God is a fact, not a symbol. And the Holy Land is that place and no other. And man is superior to the beasts. And nature is fallen. With the fall in the Garden of Eden, nature is corrupt. So we do not give ourselves to nature. We will correct nature. There is good and evil in nature. And we are supposed to be on the side of the good. So there is a tension. You don't yield to nature. These are nature worshipers. Well, what else do you have you got to worship? Some figment of your imagination that you've put up in the clouds.
Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.